You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Well, I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 21st, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Glenn Greenwald on the unprecedented assault on our press freedoms in this country by the Obama administration and its Department of Justice. Also on the program today, Apple. Literally, let's not let one bad apple ruin the whole bunch. As they evade billions of dollars in taxes. There are Senate hearings going on as we speak. Also yesterday, Occupy Our Homes, protesting in front of the Department of Justice for their complete inaction, the banking and foreclosure scandals, 17 arrested, one tased. And I'm speaking of people whose homes were foreclosed. Big non-union workers strike in D.C. today. Also, new figures on elderly poverty in this country. And Japan, a beacon for anti-austerity forces. But let's turn briefly to Oklahoma. You are, I'm sure, by now well aware, massive tornado struck Oklahoma yesterday. Considered to be, from what I understand, perhaps the biggest and most powerful tornado to hit the United States in our recorded history. 24 people died, including 9 children. The devastation was amazing. The images of this tornado, just shocking in many respects. There is a tornado watch. I know we have listeners who listen to the program in North Texas and Central Texas. There is a tornado watch. Stop listening to the program. Tune into your local news and get the word. Please stay safe. There are people who are receiving criticism, I know, on Twitter yesterday for in any way raising the issue of politics at a time like this. But the fact of the matter is the moment that that tornado is gone, the moment that the search and rescue turns to search and recover, the question becomes, who will help these people? And yes, the Red Cross is receiving donations, and yes, there are other places to donate. But the reality is that only the federal government has the capacity to help when you have a catastrophe like this in any meaningful way and in any long-term way to rebuild the lives of these people. And so it necessarily becomes political at that moment. Not small bore politics in terms of who's going to get elected and this and that. We're talking about politics in terms of the way it affects policy. And in the wake of this tornado, you have Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn says that he will seek aid, federal aid, for victims of this tornado, but only if the cost of this aid is offset by budget cuts somewhere else in our federal government. I guess Tom Coburn needs some measure of respect for maintaining consistency. But consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, particularly when it means that you are going to either provide no aid from Tom Coburn's perspective to these people whose lives have been devastated, or you're going to necessarily hurt other people. That is the policy choice that he is offering. James Inhofe, the other Oklahoma senator who joined Tom Coburn in voting against aid for Hurricane Sandy relief, has told MSNBC that this situation is totally different. That aid was pork laden. That the aid that he will request or vote for in the case of his own constituents is going to be totally different. There'll be no pork in that. It'll just be to rebuild people's lives. I don't know which one of these senators presents a more despicable attitude. But in both instances, this is not political. This is simply policy oriented. In both situations, their perspective is completely warped and indicative of a real problem that people with this ideology have when it comes to acknowledging that the federal government has an important role to play in people's lives. Not just in their everyday lives, but also in those moments where tragedy strikes. But the fact of the matter is that tragedy strikes Americans, different Americans at all times. Whether they have become bankrupt because of medical bills, whether they have lost a job because their corporation is outsourcing, whether they are being shot by guns, whether they are unable to get medical care because of where they live, they are unable to reach their potential because they are mired in poverty, because their kids and their family doesn't have enough money to feed them. It doesn't happen to every American at all times, but at any time, Americans are suffering because of choices not that they made. Whether those disasters are on an epic scale or just simply confined to their own home and their own lives. And these two senators are stuck in an ideology and in a political reality that they have, in many respects, created for themselves that forces them to ignore that reality. So it's perfectly warranted to disabuse them of that idea and to point out the fallacy of that position. There's nothing else that I can do sitting here in New York short of donating a couple of dollars to the Red Cross, other than to say that that ideology is demented. And so that's what I'll do. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Glenn Greenwald. All right. I neglected to say before the break that this interview was pre-taped this morning, just literally half an hour ago. So here is that interview with Glenn Greenwald. We are back on the Majority Report. Joining me now, it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program a columnist for The Guardian and as well as a best-selling author, Glenn Greenwald. Glenn, welcome back.
Great to be back, Sam.
So over the past couple of weeks now, we have seen it has come to light, something that you have been warning people since, this goes back to the Bush administration in some respects as well, but warning people particularly since the beginning of the prosecution of WikiLeaks, and that is that the Obama administration has begun to set precedents where it is not simply attacking leaks in its own administration. It is, in many respects, criminalizing the news gathering process. Let's just start with the AP revelations and what that indicates. And of course, it goes further with this latest revelation about a Fox News reporter, Rosen. But let's start with the AP.
Right. I actually think the revelation yesterday about the Fox reporter is a huge escalation beyond even what the AP was. But the AP controversy is very significant in itself because it was a massive invasion on the part of the Justice Department into the communications that AP journalists and editors had with a variety of people over the course of weeks. It turned out that they obtained the phone records for multiple AP bureaus, as well as it turns out, we learned yesterday, the phone, home phone, and cell phones of those journalists and editors as well, which means that they were able to learn the identity of every person with whom those AP journalists communicated by telephone during that period of time. Now, what made this so disturbing is that it is the case that in a leak investigation, the Justice Department has the power, the legal authority, to obtain the phone records of people that they think might reveal the identity of the leakers. But when it comes to doing that with regard to journalists, there's a whole variety of rules in place because of how threatening to press freedoms that kind of invasiveness is, one of which is that in almost every case, the Justice Department is supposed to notify the media outlet in advance that it is seeking these phone records, because that would then enable the journalist to either negotiate a narrower, more reasonable way to get these records or to go into court and ask a judge to rule on whether or not the attempt is legal and proper. And in this case, the Justice Department didn't tell AP until after it had obtained these phone records that it was doing so, depriving them of the opportunity to do anything about it, just went and secretly got all of the phone records for all these AP journalists. And the reason that's so damaging is because journalists rely on the ability to speak to sources confidentially without the government knowing about it in order to gather news. That's how every investigative journalist for the last many decades has reported on what the government is doing. And if the government can now just invade that process and learn the identity of the people with whom journalists are speaking, it makes the job of journalists impossible.
Now we should be clear here. What the Justice Department in the case of the AP was subpoena these records. They didn't read the emails. They simply subpoenaed the records. And as you say, they did it in secret when generally it's done with the opportunity of some form of judicial review, unless they can come out with a negotiated settlement with the media agency. So in many respects, you could also perceive what the Justice Department did here in the AP case was explicitly and specifically to avoid any type of judicial review of this investigation. And it raises certain questions as to why they wouldn't want some type of judicial review. The other aspect of the AP records is how broad of a period of time and how many phones that they covered. This also, at the very least, brushes up against their guidelines. I mean, in this instance, because there's no judicial review, they're completely... they have complete autonomy in determining whether or not they have violated their own guidelines, which is also problematic.
Right. I mean, here's how judicial proceedings typically work. Is if you are in a civil lawsuit with another party, or if you're involved in a criminal proceeding with the government, if one side wants to obtain records from a third party, it issues a subpoena, and at the same time, it sends notice of that subpoena to the other side so that if the subpoena is objectionable or legally baseless, that party can run into court and ask a judge to quash the subpoena and to say you should either limit it or quash it entirely because there's no legal basis for it, it's too intrusive, those kind of things. In the Justice Department's guidelines, it does say that the normal course of action when you're subpoenaing records of a media outlet should be to go to the journalistic entity ahead of time to give them that opportunity. And the only exception is where the integrity of the investigation would be jeopardized if you give advance notice. And what that normally means is if you tell a media outlet in advance that you're trying to get certain records and telling them ahead of time would enable them to destroy that evidence, that would then jeopardize the integrity of the investigation and justify you're doing it without telling them. In this case, that doesn't even remotely apply because the records weren't in the possession of the AP. They were in the possession of their telephone carriers, Verizon and AT&T. So AP, even if there was some danger that they were going to destroy the records once they found out the Justice Department was pursuing them, wouldn't have even had the physical capability to do that. It would have remained exactly where it was. Those records weren't going anywhere. There was no reason to avoid telling AP, other than a desire on the part of the Justice Department to avoid having a judge rule on whether this sweeping, invasive, quite threatening request was legally proper or not. And the other point I just want to make is this idea of these guidelines that the Justice Department has adopted. Over the past several decades, there have been lots of debates in Washington about whether laws need to be enacted to protect journalists from these kinds of actions on the part of the government. And what the government has always said is, look, you don't need a separate law to protect journalists because we have all these really restrictive guidelines that we follow that if we ever want to get the records of journalists, the phone records or the email records, we have all these really great restrictions in place. The attorney general himself has to sign off on it. Our policy is to tell them in advance. So that they can go into court except in the rarest of cases. We only do it as an absolute last resort if there's no other way to get this information. So these guidelines are what the Justice Department has always pointed to as a way of telling Congress you don't need to pass laws protecting journalists. So when the Justice Department goes and violates their own guidelines in the way that they did in this case, it's really quite a serious thing.
And we should also say that back in 2009, when a media shield law was being proposed in the Senate, the Obama administration specifically pressured the senators who were raising this issue to water it down significantly, really to the point of it having no efficacy. Again, to allow the Justice Department to have almost total autonomy in making the determinations as to whether or not what they're doing is appropriate, and removing that authority specifically in at least this is the reporting that Charlie Savage did, removing the authority of judges to weigh in on whether or not the Justice Department requests are legitimate on national security grounds. And so, you know, we should make this clear because it is at the very least indicative of the Obama administration's position on this from the very beginning of their administration.
Right. I mean, what it was interesting because when this AP controversy erupted, the instinct of a lot of progressive commentators, sort of MSNBC types, is in every single case to figure out how to blame Republicans. So they had kind of a dilemma, which was, well, here's something that the Obama Justice Department did, not because anyone passed a law forcing them to do it, but because they simply chose on their own to do it. How can we blame Republicans for this? And the solution that they came up with was to say, well, look, the Republicans filibustered and blocked the enactment of a law in 2007 that Obama favored when he was in the Senate that would have protected journalists. It was true, that claim, only to a very limited extent, because that law that they blocked probably wouldn't have provided much protection for AP in this specific case. It's also a really bizarre thing to try and blame Republicans for blocking a law that would have given journalists protection from the Obama administration. I mean, even though journalists don't have the statutory protection, nothing forces the Obama administration to go and invade the news gathering process this way. But what really made it a kind of misleading argument was that although it is true that Obama, when he was in the Senate, favored laws that would have protected the journalists from these kind of government intrusions, once he became president, he basically reversed his position and started opposing these kind of laws unless they were watered down to the point of meaninglessness by including the national security exemption that you just described. And the reason that law didn't get enacted, according to lots of press freedom advocates and transparency advocates and people who have been advocating for these kind of laws for a long time, is precisely because of the actions of the White House, not the Republicans. And you know, but at the end of the day, although the Justice Department shouldn't be, and there's no evidence that in this case they were, taking immediate direction from the White House, it is the Justice Department that's making this choice to invade and target journalists this way. And I think the key point here is that it is all part of this broader climate that President Obama has established, as you said, from the start, which is to be more aggressive with safeguarding secrecy and attacking whistleblowers than any administration in U.S. history, and any president in U.S. history. And the key stat to that is that the Obama administration has prosecuted double the number of whistleblowers under espionage statutes than all prior administrations combined.
Now, last week, the Attorney General Holder was in front of a committee basically going over the some of the scandals, including the AP question. And he was asked by Representative Hank Johnson, a Democrat from Georgia, about the notion of prosecuting reporters. And he went on to say, I'm quoting Holder here, "You've got a long way to go to prosecute people, the press, for the publication of that material. This has not fared well in American history. With regard to the potential prosecution of the press for the disclosure of material that is not something that I've ever been involved in, heard, or would think would be a wise policy. The focus should be on those people who break their oath and put the American people at risk, not reporters who gather this information." Now, this was last week. Either Eric Holder was lying or has been completely in the dark as to what his Department of Justice has been doing, and both in regard to WikiLeaks, but also, as the story broke yesterday, in regards to to James Rosen, a Fox News reporter. Tell us about that story of James Rosen.
Okay, so let's start with the WikiLeaks criminal investigation that the Justice Department has been conducting and by all accounts still is conducting, and that Eric Holder has publicly defended.
And we, I should just say, Alexa O'Brien on Twitter today, as late as today, has reconfirmed that the grand jury is continuing their investigation into WikiLeaks.
Right. This is a criminal investigation to prosecute WikiLeaks for crimes. And what's crucial here to realize is that the analogy that is often made to WikiLeaks, what WikiLeaks did, is to the New York Times publication of the Pentagon Papers, which was leaked by Daniel Ellsberg. And in that case, it was Ellsberg who was the quasi-government official who obtained the information and then gave it to the New York Times. And it was the New York Times acting as the journalistic entity that then published it. The New York Times didn't obtain it, they didn't steal it, they received it from a government source, Daniel Ellsberg. In the case of WikiLeaks, The analogy is not that WikiLeaks is Daniel Ellsberg. Bradley Manning is Daniel Ellsberg. Bradley Manning is the official, the government employee who obtained the classified information. He then passed it on to WikiLeaks, which then published it. WikiLeaks was acting essentially as the New York Times here. They were publishing information that a government source had provided them. WikiLeaks had no obligation to keep that information confidential. They didn't work for the government. They didn't obtain it. They simply received it from their source, just like the New York Times did then, and the New York Times and other newspapers do all the time. And so the question arose for the U.S. government, which is, well, we want to prosecute WikiLeaks, which clearly they do and said they want to do. How is it that we can prosecute WikiLeaks when they really did nothing more than act as news outlets do all the time? They received classified information from a government source and then published it. And of course, the New York Times and the newspaper for which I write, The Guardian, and other media outlets also published that same material that originated from Bradley Manning. And the answer that the Holder Justice Department came up with was to invent this new theory that said, okay, we can't prosecute WikiLeaks simply for publishing this information because that's pure journalistic behavior that's protected by the freedom of the press. It would be too controversial for us to do. So the theory we're going to use is that WikiLeaks did not merely passively receive the classified information. They actively were conspirators in the effort to obtain it. They encouraged Manning to obtain this classified information and disclose it. They plotted with him on how to do it. They set up a secret chat room where Manning could go and pass this information on to WikiLeaks, that they took steps as conspirators with Manning rather than passively receiving the information and then publishing it, and that's what makes them liable criminally for this conduct. And the reason that's such a menacing and radical and dangerous theory is because every single investigative journalist, every single day virtually, does exactly that. It's almost never the case that investigative journalists simply passively receive classified information. Like one day it just shows up in your email box and, oh my, what a surprise, I got a nice little present today, this massive trove of classified information that I'm not now going to write about. It's almost always the case that investigative journalism entails the journalist and the source working together collaboratively. They figure out how they can communicate in secret. They figure out how the information is going to be given in a way that isn't traceable. There's lots of encouragement on the part of the journalist to talk the source into doing it, because there's usually fear at the last minute about doing it. So if you adopt the theory that the Justice Department tried to embrace for to prosecute WikiLeaks, which is that journalists can be criminally liable as conspirators when they work with government sources to disclose classified information, you're basically rendering all investigative journalism itself criminal. And that was what I was writing at the time that this theory was first disclosed. With regard to WikiLeaks, was that if you accept this theory, you're criminalizing investigative journalism. I was urging every journalist to stand up for WikiLeaks, if for no other reason than to protect themselves. And it turns out that we now know that exactly what some of us predicted would happen has now happened, which is that the Holder Justice Department has used this theory to label as criminal other people that we consider as sort of mainstream classical journalists. So what was revealed yesterday was that the Justice Department has been prosecuting a State Department advisor, Stephen Kim, because he allegedly told a Fox News journalist, the Washington bureau chief James Rosen, that intelligence reports had said that if North Korea ends up being sanctioned by the UN, they'll likely respond with nuclear tests, more nuclear tests and protests. Not a very fascinating or dangerous leak, just a way of trying to show the public that North Korea is more dangerous than people think. And so the Justice Department has been investigating and prosecuting Stephen Kim for this leak. And in order to prove that he actually was the leaker, they went to a court, again in secret, and asked the court for a search warrant to obtain the content of the emails of James Rosen for 2 days with everybody and all of the emails that he ever exchanged with Stephen Kim so that they could read through this journalist's emails. And as part of their search warrant, they needed to demonstrate to the court that there was probable cause to believe that James Rosen had committed a crime. That's the standard they had to meet to get the search warrant. And so what they argued was that not just Stephen Kim, the State Department employee, had committed crimes by disclosing this classified information, but that James Rosen himself, the journalist, had also committed crimes by acting as a co-conspirator with Stephen Kim and the disclosure of the classified information. It used the exact WikiLeaks theory I just described. It said James Rosen encouraged the leaking of the classified information. He arranged for a covert communication scheme. That's what the search warrant called it, whereby they would communicate in secret in the way that wouldn't be detected. And said there's probable cause to believe that James Rosen, the journalist, has violated the Espionage Act by being a co-conspirator in the leak. And that really is a formal declaration by the U.S. government that what investigative journalists do every single day is a serious felony, a serious criminal offense. They're not prosecuting James Rosen yet. He hasn't been indicted. The papers clearly show they were considering that, but it is a formal declaration by the Obama administration that the nuts and bolts of investigative journalism, in their view, is now a criminal offense. And that is, in my view, as critical as I've been of the Obama Justice Department, the single most dangerous thing that they've done to date.
And so how does one square the notion that in this application for a search warrant that was approved by a federal magistrate, we should say, how does one square that with Eric Holder's claiming to Congress that with regard to the potential prosecution of the press for disclosure of material, this is not something I've ever been involved in, heard of, or would think would be a wise policy? I mean, can you square?
Right.
Is that possible to reconcile those?
Well, first of all, about the search warrant, let me just say that when the government goes to get a search warrant, they go by themselves. There's nobody else present. And especially in national security cases, judges are extremely deferential to the government. This wasn't even a real U.S. district judge. It was just a magistrate judge who doesn't even have life tenure. It's the easiest thing in the world to get a search warrant from a judge when you claim national security. So that really doesn't mean much about the validity. But as far as your specific question about Holder, you know, I would guess that Holder would parse that statement in a very lawyerly, legalistic way in order to say that, well, we didn't prosecute James Rosen here. We haven't seriously considered prosecuting him. All we did was tell a court that we believed he engaged in criminal conduct. So when I went into Congress and said that I've never been involved in planning to prosecute journalists or discussing prosecuting journalists, that can be reconciled with what we told this federal court, because even though we labeled him formally as a criminal, we never prosecuted him and never seriously got to the point where we thought we should. And I would guess that would be his reply.
I mean, what's stunning about this is that if you perceive the reporter's actions, if you compare Rosen's actions with that of WikiLeaks and you put it on a spectrum, in fact, it seems to me that it's quite obvious that WikiLeaks was far less involved in the disclosure of what Bradley Manning's information was than Rosen was in the disclosure of what Kim's was. So in many respects, the silence by the press when in regards to the ongoing investigation of WikiLeaks is that much more reprehensible in some respects, because clearly, for I think the advantage of all of us, the press is now sort of woken up with this Rosen case, but it is pretty stunning.
Well, I mean, it's stunning for so many reasons. First of all, there is reporting by James Goodall, who was the general counsel of the New York Times during the papers fights with the Nixon administration over the Pentagon Papers, in which he wrote that after Nixon went to the Supreme Court and tried to restrain the New York Times in advance from publishing the Pentagon Papers, and the Supreme Court rejected that effort, saying the government doesn't have the right of prior restraint in this case under the First Amendment, Nixon became obsessed with prosecuting the New York Times reporter who published the Pentagon Papers, Neil Sheehan. And his theory that the Nixon Justice Department used, or was going to use when they convened the grand jury, was that Sheehan had conspired with Ellsberg to engage in this leak by doing all the things that we've just talked about, creating secret ways of communicating, encouraging Ellsberg to do it, enabling it. So it has been known for so long that this theory – was a very dangerous weapon that Richard Nixon tried to create in order to prosecute the New York Times for publishing the Pentagon Papers. So to then sit by and watch the Obama DOJ embrace the same theory as a means of prosecuting WikiLeaks and say nothing about it, except when you're sort of supporting it and encouraging it, is unbelievably self-destructive, aside from all the other reasons why it's grotesque behavior, you know, failing to safeguard First Amendment rights when you're a journalist and the like. It's so glaringly self-threatening, this theory, that to allow it to take root just because you don't like WikiLeaks is incredibly irresponsible and really quite stupid. And, you know, as you say, I mean, the usually journalists are far more involved with their sources than WikiLeaks was with Manning. I mean, they, you know, the Obama Justice Department, remember, the Obama administration held Manning in such oppressive conditions for so many months. The UN ultimately formally investigated and found that the conditions of his detention were both inhuman and cruel, in their words. And the State Department spokesman P.J. Crawley resigned over it. They were attempting for months to get Manning to implicate WikiLeaks and to say that WikiLeaks was a participant in what he did. And to this day, Manning steadfastly refused to say that. And in fact, in his statement that he made when he pled guilty to many of the charges, he said WikiLeaks essentially didn't have anything to do with the decision I made to go and get these documents and didn't really help me or participate in any way.
In fact, so, he attempted to give these documents to other news outlets before WikiLeaks.
Right, and they just didn't respond to him or didn't take him seriously. And so you're absolutely right that if WikiLeaks can be held criminally responsible or be the subject of a grand jury investigation for 2 years based on this theory, virtually every investigative reporter at every major media outlet in the United States can be held criminally accountable far more easily than WikiLeaks can under this theory that they allowed to take root simply because they have animosity towards WikiLeaks.
And with the amount of classification that the Obama administration has overseen in terms of classifying a whole new sort of, a whole new set of documents as classified, it's almost impossible to imagine that there is a newsroom in the country that wouldn't have one reporter who couldn't be subject to this type of prosecution.
I mean, absolutely. Look, I mean, I don't, you know, I do mostly opinion journalism, but I periodically have reported on classified information. I'm actually working on a couple of things now that involve that. Every single thing that you do when you do that kind of reporting entails talking to your source about the means that you're going to use to communicate, about how to cover up what it is that you're doing so nobody finds out about it in advance. You always find ways to encourage your source to do it by explaining to them the reasons why it's a noble and productive thing to do. You talk them out of their fears. You talk them through the process. If you go and talk to any investigative journalist in the United States, any investigative journalist in the United States, as I've done many times over the past 4 years, who work for the most protected and entrenched institution, they will all tell you that they have that they are now operating in a climate of unprecedented fear. Their sources are afraid, and they're afraid. They're petrified. Even, I mean, the nation's most celebrated investigative journalist, probably at this point, James Risen, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for exposing the Bush administration's warrantless eavesdropping program, who works for the New York Times, is in the middle of an extremely serious litigation where he faces jail time because he refuses to divulge communications that he had with one of his sources, who is now the target of one of these Obama prosecutions. And this climate of fear has made it very difficult. They all say, Jane Mayer has said it in the last couple of weeks, Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times said it, has made it very difficult for them to report on what the government is doing. What the Obama DOJ is deliberately doing is making it so that the only information the American public can learn about is information that the government itself discloses, and making all other information that they don't want disclosed impossible to learn about. And that is a real threat to press freedom, and it's a recipe for having a model of government propaganda where the only information that we get to learn about is information that the government wants us to know.
I mean, this is the point that I think can't be emphasized enough, is that the Obama administration has been very generous in terms of leaks when it's information that they want to reveal. They will allow for a movie to be made on the capture of Osama bin Laden. They will continually feed journalists leaks as long as they can control this. And so this is really a question of seen holistically. We have a government that has classified documents at a rate top secret at a rate faster than any other administration. We have seen an increase in the national security state and simultaneously met with a crackdown on the ability of the United of U.S. citizens to know what's going on within their government.
Yeah, I mean, this is, to me, the key issue, which is it would be one thing if the Obama administration were really serious about protecting classified information. I would certainly disagree with their secrecy obsession in that case, but at least it would be an authentic claim. The Obama administration loves leaks of classified information. I don't think there's been a government, an administration that has used leaks more prolifically or manipulatively than they have. I mean, they constantly go into court and tell courts that they cannot respond to requests under the Freedom of Information Act or to media requests or to congressional inquiries because all kinds of things that those entities are investigating are so secret. And yet they then go to the New York Times and to other media outlets and leak prolifically, profusely about those very same programs in order to make the president look strong and tough and powerful and boast about all the great things he's doing in the classified setting. So what they're doing is they're making sure that information that glorifies Obama gets leaked continuously, but any information that might be used to check the authenticity of those claims that the government is making or to expose information that doesn't make the president look good is suppressed using the force of law. And it's this manipulative abuse of secrecy powers that is so threatening and that the Obama administration has really taken to all new heights.
In fact, I mean, we know that Marcy Wheeler has been doing tremendous work on this, but it is quite clear from what we know and what has been reported in various outlets that at the very least, ostensibly the leak that the AP records were subpoenaed for, the leak essentially came from John Brennan. Maybe inadvertently, maybe not. We just don't know. But the idea that there was the CIA had an inside or the intelligence agencies that working with the CIA had an inside operator with this bomb plot, this so-called Underwear Bomber 2 plot, we know came from John Brennan in his attempt to spin, essentially, some former counterterrorism officials who were about to go on TV. And so it's just one more example of, I mean, do you think, it's very hard to get into sort of the mind of Obama and the administration, but what accounts for this? I mean, it can't simply be the politics of it. There's something else that has taken hold here that it doesn't necessarily have to do with electoral politics, because, of course, at this point, we're behind that. These type of issues are fairly, I mean, I don't feel like the American public's paying much attention to it one way or another. I don't think the American public was terribly invested in Thomas Drake being hounded for years after the Bush administration. What accounts for this? I appreciate that this is, you know, complete speculation, but in your sense, what accounts for this?
I think that when people get into power who believe in their own goodness, they begin to believe that their conduct is justifiable inherently because they are good people who, by definition, are pursuing good ends. And I think it's very much how Obama and the people who surround him see themselves. And when you see yourself that way, as an inherently good person pursuing inherently good ends, you start to believe that you don't actually need checks or scrutiny or oversight from other institutions, because that's only for people who have malicious motives. And you can even begin to believe, in fact, that checks from other institutions filled with people who aren't as good as you are actually destructive or counterproductive. And I think we saw that with Obama's belief that the U.S. should go to war in Libya, and he continued to prosecute that war even once the GOP-led House rejected the war's authorization. And if you talk to Obama supporters to this day, they will say that was the right thing to do because the House is controlled by these evil Republicans, and so you can't be constrained by what that institution decides, even though the Constitution says that war shall only be fought with the authorization of Congress. And I think Obama has a view of himself that is one that sees himself as this inherently good person, and there's no need, therefore, for transparency in what he does. And he believes that his behavior that his power will be enhanced and made more effective if he can do everything in secret, which is true. When you can act in secret, you are able to act more powerfully. And that this is a desirable end because his power is a good thing. And I believe that's what's driving it.
And the paradox, of course, here is that the constitutional law professor in him compels him in some way to codify this and to bring it within some type of schema of statutory authority. And which is incredibly problematic in that, one, we are now taking stuff that was initiated in many respects by a administration that, by all accounts, had gone rogue in some respects. And now it is being codified into law. So all of these powers that President Obama perceives that he should have because of his very nature are now going to be imparted to any president who follows him.
I mean, this is always the key point. There's two key points about this. One is that whenever the government wants to abuse rights, they always target, in the first instance, somebody that they think is marginalized and unpopular so that people will acquiesce to it or be supportive of it. And once that happens, those rights abuses get institutionalized and nobody can object after that once other targets start to emerge. And that's exactly what happened. That's why they first embraced this theory by targeting WikiLeaks, knowing that journalists hate WikiLeaks and that nobody would mind. But then once nobody minds, that theory becomes institutionalized. And then when they start applying it to people these journalists like, there's no way to object. But the converse of it is what you just said, which is that you can vest a certain political leader with power because you trust that politician to exercise it for the good. If you like Obama and you trust him, you can say, I'm fine with him targeting U.S. citizens for execution without due process by CIA drone because I trust him to only kill the bad people, or I'm fine with him engaging in things in secret. I'm fine with him deciding which journalists should be labeled criminals because I trust him to exercise it appropriately. But the next time there's a GOP president and a Republican administration, a Republican Justice Department decides that an MSNBC journalist should be labeled a criminal or even be prosecuted, it'll be almost impossible for any good progressive to support what Obama is doing now to object because they will have endorsed the principle that the president has this power. And you cannot support a power being invested in a president whom you like and then turn around and object to that power being in the hands of a president you dislike. That is not how political systems work. The president either has a particular power or they don't. And whether the power is one that you support should be determined by how that power to be exercised by a president that you don't trust, not one that you do trust.
And lastly, Glenn, to the extent that there's any chance that this policy direction, this drift, as it were, or I don't know if drift maybe understates it, is reversed, how does this end? I mean, I don't see a huge concern amongst the American public. You raise the issue that largely those on the left who had problems with this during the Bush administration are silent in this regard. I mean, we're starting to see some media pay attention to this. How does this get reversed? I mean, do we need a massive scandal on the size of I'm just looking. What is our COINTELPRO moment? What is our Watergate moment? When is there any mechanism to reverse this, because I don't see anybody in Congress really stepping up on this issue to the extent that we see even the Republicans complain about it. They have no problem with the AP thing. It's all IRS or Benghazi at this point.
Right, and you even saw Mitch McConnell came out and said that and defended Obama, the Obama administration, in terms of the AP controversy on the grounds that national security leaks are very dangerous and we need to investigate them. And it wasn't surprising that the Republicans were supportive of attacking journalists since the Bush administration started to do that as well. We'll see what happens with the Fox, now that Fox is in the crosshairs. But I think the key point here is that, you know, if you read what the founders talked about in terms of how abuses of power would be checked and constrained, the assumption that they had was that human beings were desirous of power and freedom, and that therefore it would be the role of each institution to defend its own prerogative. So if the executive branch tried to encroach on congressional authority, it would be Congress that had the means to push back. And that principle applies to the media, so that the principal obligation to defend press freedom lies with journalists themselves. They have a significant amount of influence. And you saw this week, I think, with the targeting of the AP and then James Rosen, some pretty serious outcry on the part of journalists for the first time over what has been 5 years now of sustained Obama attacks on press freedom. It remains to be seen whether that will endure, how serious they will be. They do have weapons that they can use to push back against the administration, whether they're serious enough about defending their press freedoms. In order to use them, I think remains an open question. Of course, the problem with most journalism over the past decade has been an excessive deference to government power and a desire to stay in its good graces. And they have repeatedly avoided doing anything that would give rise to the kind of confrontations that the New York Times pursued with the Nixon administration 4 decades ago. It's certainly time for them to take seriously these threats to their own freedom. If they don't do it, it's hard for me to see who will. It's their freedoms to and I hope that they will continue doing what they did this last week with finally processing what a serious really is and taking seriously their need to denounce it.
Glenn Greenwald, it is always both a pleasure and a horror to talk to you.
Thank you, Sam. That's very nice.
All right, Glenn. Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Talk to you soon.
Okay. All right, folks. That was Glenn Greenwald. And I just want to apologize for some of the sound issues on that call. Glenn is calling from, not overseas necessarily. It depends on how you fly, but from a different hemisphere. So the phone connections are not always great, but it's always a pleasure to speak to him. Always a pleasure and a horror in some respects. Okay. All right. And now, folks, we've gone a little bit over today, but you're welcome for those of you who receive this program for free. And to those of you who support the program, I say thank you. I mean, I say thank you to everybody for listening. But I also say special thank you. There's a thank you and there's a thank you. And there's tears of thank you. Yes, thank you, Michael. And that tear is the lowest of the tears.
That was, I was gonna say, I felt very low.
That was a low tier thank you. I give a mid-level thank you to everyone for listening. And then a high tier of thank you to those of you who are supporting the program, which you all can do by becoming a member today at majority.fm. Of course, our Amazon link, if you buy crap through Amazon, it costs you nothing to go to majority.fm. Click on the link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a little kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Join me in the better half of the program, where we'll talk about a huge mound of waste in the city of Detroit. Isn't that lovely? Brought to you by the Koch brothers. I kid you not. Also on the program today, what's that?
I was expecting Koch brothers, to be honest.
It's,
I kid you not, was totally not necessary because
I know. We'll dig into this Apple question of Apple, which is really the question of most of corporate America, big corporate America, shielding billions, literally, so by some estimates, over trillions of dollars in taxes that they would otherwise pay, except for they've figured out how to game the system. Also announced earlier this week, the war on terror, it's going to last for nearly forever. I mean, what is forever? It really is really a metaphysical question, but apparently the plans are for it to last a long, long time. Talk about the non-union workers striking in D.C. They're supported by your tax dollars, but to the tune of very little in wages. Also, more poverty statistics, which puts puts to shame the idea that somehow Social Security in and of itself has already solved the elderly poverty problem in this country. And a wonderful, heartwarming story of nepotism, which is so far hard to find in this day and age. And an interesting story on the value of malpractice litigation to cutting costs and improving care for hospitals. I know we've been told so many times in the past that malpractice reform is so necessary to cut healthcare costs. Well, we've seen healthcare costs drop, and we're actually seeing now the benefits, according to the study, of malpractice litigation. All that and more, folks. Your phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I will also take your email, your IMs at Majority FM as we go into the better half of the program. See you soon.